to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Assistant Professor of Asia-Pacific Policy Studies at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Julian Dierkes, speaks on fewer children, more customers, changes in Japan's supplementary education system. Dr. Julian Dierkes is the Kadandran Chair in Japanese Research at the Institute of Asian Research of the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, where he has taught Asia-Pacific Policy Studies since 2002. He also serves as the Associate Director of the Center for Japanese Research and as the Coordinator of the Program on Inner Asia. Dr. Dierkes's research includes a comparative examination of history education in post-war Japan and the former East and West Germany, the political aspects of education reform in Japan, as well as legal education reform in Japan. He has undertaken comparative studies of how different countries deal with issues surrounding globalization, specifically Canada, members of the EU, and Japan. Dr. Dierkes is also growing increasingly involved in research regarding numerous aspects of Mongolian society, from regulation of the mining industry to the changing role of religion in traditional medicine. Additionally, he is developing a catalog of online sociology resources. Among Dr. Dierkes's current research projects are ones specifically focused on reform in Japanese education. Dr. Dierkes holds both a PhD and an MA in sociology from Princeton University and a BA in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley. Currently on sabbatical, today Dr. Dierkes lives in Homer, Alaska with his wife and three children. On Friday, May 8th, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on fewer children, more customers, changes in Japan's supplementary education system. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Assistant Professor of Asia-Pacific Policy Studies at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, Dr. Julian Dierkes.
Okay, good afternoon, almost afternoon, everyone. Terrific opportunity, lovely to see so many people here. I want to thank the council and those involved with its work for giving me this opportunity. Paul mentioned that we're living in Homer for the year. I'm on sabbatical from UBC, and I've been holed up working on some manuscripts and doing a bit more research in Japan. But this is really a terrific opportunity for me to try to share a little bit of the research that I'm doing currently and try to place it in a bit of a broader context that hopefully some of you who might not necessarily be Japan scholars or education scholars, or perhaps not even scholars at all, might find interesting nevertheless. So what I want to talk about in the presentation is the intersection or the intermingling of two trends that we see globally at the moment. And one is demographic, and the other one is regarding policy making and policy more broadly. The first trend that you can observe around the world, really, is a decline of birth rates. This is true as much of developing countries as it is of developed countries. Of course, it's common to OECD countries, to developed countries. It's more pronounced there than it is in developing countries. As you're all aware, the U.S. and other immigrant societies are a bit of an exception to this, where birth rates have generally remained somewhat higher. But Japan, when you look at this overall global trend, Japan has been ahead of the curve in this regard, and some of the trends that we see in a lot of European countries now and across Asia as well started a bit earlier in Japan and are somewhat more pronounced. And so the easiest way to look at demographics, or the most easily understood way, is the total fertility rate, so the average number that of children that a woman will have in her lifetime. And for Japan, that's currently somewhere around 1.22. As you probably know, replacement for a population is somewhere around 2.1, and 1.22 means essentially that every family has 1 1/4 child, where the quarter obviously is distributed across a number of families. It just for comparison purposes, I listed here for the U.S., that number is somewhere around 2.1. So the U.S. population without immigration is essentially reproducing itself through births and deaths, but Japan is not. Just out of curiosity, the Alaskan rate is slightly higher than it is for the rest of the U.S., but no need to focus on that necessarily here. The second sort of global development that I want to talk a little bit about is the rise or the emergence of education markets. Now, if you look at in a longer term, historically, of course, all education was private until somewhere around 100, 200 years ago. Most education historically was rooted in religious institutions, whether that's in native communities in North America, whether that's in Europe or in Japan. And then at some point with the emergence of the modern nation state, public education arose and sort of took over. But what we've seen over the last, call it roughly 25 years, numerous attempts to recreate to some extent or to create education markets. And you can trace a little bit of that development. Many of you will know what stir the publication of a report called Nation at Risk caused in the U.S. in the mid-80s. And the bottom line of the report essentially was, well, you know, education in the U.S. is failing in preparing children for productive working lives on an average level of achievement, even though high achievement is quite widespread in terms of literacy, numeracy, and so forth. That was a report that sort of rang the alarm bells for the U.S. and for education reform generally. That coincided, of course, in the 1980s with the Reagan-Thatcher revolution of deregulation and a withdrawal of public activities in various sectors, and that includes education, where then one of the solutions that was proposed to some of the challenges pointed out by studies like Nation at Risk was the creation or the use of market mechanisms in education to solve some of these problems and challenges. And so what we see globally is a spread of an approach to educational policy that emphasizes market mechanisms and tries to introduce market mechanisms into education. So I've listed just a number of the sort of concrete policies that you see growing out of this, especially in the U.S., but not only in the U.S. Charter schools, to some extent, were created for this purpose. Vouchers certainly were, and so forth. And this is something that we really see around the world. You don't necessarily see charter schools per se in every country around the world, but what you do see relatively clearly is that most policymakers in the field of education have, to some extent at least, over the last 20, 25 years, looked to market solutions in terms of fixing what they might perceive to be wrong with education. So let me initially then focus on a sort of a specific version of that, and that's supplementary education in Japan. The reason I want to look at that, I'll go into in a moment, but let me first say what I mean by that. And for the most part, at least in academic publications and presentations, I sort of stick with the Japanese term, juku, to refer to these institutions. The most colloquial and most easily understood term in English, at least, is probably a cram school. And that might, you know, that means a little bit to most people, but it has the disadvantage of it sure doesn't sound terribly attractive, does it? It's not the sort of thing you know, no one says, oh, I want to go to cram school, it sounds great. And it's to some extent pejorative because it implies that these kind of schools follow a pedagogy that involves cramming, right? That essentially involves teachers taking given content and trying to sort of stuff it in children's heads. And so it's a term that I would prefer not to use, at least for research purposes, even though I see some evidence of some of those activities going on. The term that some other scholars have proposed is to speak of shadow education. And that's because the kind of schools that I'm looking at, and I'll be talking about a little bit more, quite literally shadow public and official education, in that they essentially follow the same curriculum and do the same thing, just again in a different context. And so it's a term that is quite descriptive. It still doesn't sound great because there are schools that sort of exist in the shadows, and that's to some extent intended. My struggle with that as a term is what do I call the school? Shadow school sounds rather odd, so I've kind of stuck to the Japanese term and have used that. So bear with me. Juku as a term hopefully will become familiar to you over the next couple of minutes. Juku in Japan teach just about anything you can think of. They certainly teach the academic subjects that primary and secondary students are interested in, but they also teach traditional arts of various forms. Something that teaches tea ceremony, for example, or ikebana, flower arranging. So that institution is usually called a juku. So it's a term that applies to a whole variety of things. Oftentimes, sports are learned in the context of something called a juku, piano to some extent and the like, and it's various lifelong learning activities, adult education and so forth. All those things are often called a juku, What I want to focus on is the academic juku, and by that I mean juku that parallel school education, K-12, and so that teach subjects that are also present in the K-12 curriculum and that primarily are oriented towards students of those age groups. The juku themselves then offer afternoon and weekend sessions that are seen to be in addition to regular schooling. And so school children in Japan will go to a juku weekday afternoons or on the weekends, to some extent during vacation as well, when that happens. It's one of the reasons why the term cram school, in my mind, doesn't work terribly well, is because juku, at least now in Japan, offer both remedial as well as accelerated education. So some of the juku are focused on essentially tutoring for children who've fallen behind in their learning, or for whatever reason may have missed some class time or so forth, but they're also catering to students who want to jump ahead of what their schools are doing. And so they're doing both those aspects of education are present in the juku very much. And as I want to emphasize, though, that they're doing no more and no less than the official curriculum. There's almost no departure that I've been able to find or see of where juku offer any additional subjects or different content than what the school curriculum prescribes. And so in that sense, they very, very literally shadow what is going on in schools. Just a few words of where these juku came from, because it's a question that if you think about the U.S., of course, or Canada or most of Europe, some institutions like the juku exist, right? If you think of the various SAT preparatory courses that outfits like Kaplan or Princeton Review are offering, there's bigger chains like Sylvan Learning Centers are pretty big in Canada, I think in the U.S. as well. So there are some businesses that have sort of a same purpose, but I think it's relatively fair to say that certainly compared to Japan and some other societies, there are no juku of that sort in North America, or there are very few of them. And so one of the questions that I start out with in this research is to say, well, why do juku exist in the first place? And it's kind of a fun question for research, because I can take it to interviewees in Japan and I can startle them, which is always a good start for a discussion, because it's especially the children, the students, but also teachers in juku and in schools have never really thought about the fact that maybe other countries don't necessarily have juku. And so then I try to elicit answers from them, and I've tried to list some of the answers that I get. The first answer I usually get is people say, well, we always had juku in Japan. And so they usually draw references to temple schools, for example, to teakoya that existed in the pre-modern period and were places where local children could go for reading, writing instruction. They'll refer to the use of the term juku itself. For example, one of the most famous universities in Japan, Keio University, initially had that word juku in its name as well. And so people say, well, we've always had these, so no surprise that we still do now. But it turns out there were almost no juku in the immediate post-war era. And juku in the way that they exist now did not really exist in the 1950s and 60s and reemerged in the 1970s. And so that historical continuity was at least broken, and it's not entirely clear to me that juku today are doing anything that the temple schools may have been doing 150 years ago or so. So at least in my mind, that certainly is part of the story, that there are some historical continuities, but it's certainly not the only reason, and may not be a sufficient reason as well. Then another answer I get all the time as well, especially East Asian societies place a huge emphasis on education, both in terms of the reality of educational achievement and the impact it has on socioeconomic status. That certainly is true in the sense that upward mobility in Japan is primarily mediated by education. So yes, indeed, gaining an education is one way to upward mobility if you find that desirable in Japan. The other side of that coin is that overall education has been valued very highly, that families are quite willing to dedicate resources to education. And so that's why you have this whole shadow education system emerging. Well, you know, if you look at the U.S., it's not that people don't value education. I mean, if you want to help your career chances, then, and of course I have to say this with great pride as a university professor, of course going to university is a good thing and is really going to help your chances, not necessarily in all areas. As I've learned over the last year, actually, all my university education means absolutely nothing in Homer, Alaska. But that's sort of a different question. It might be very specific to Homer. But education is still the way that upward mobility is one of the avenues towards upward mobility in places like the U.S. And certainly if you look at American or North American or European universities, you could also conclude that given the amount of resources devoted to science, technology, education, that education certainly is valued in places outside of East Asia. And so that, to me, doesn't necessarily seem to be the whole story either, even though it's part of all this. And again, with high-stakes testing as an answer that people have given, why do JUKU exist? People say, well, because in order to get into university, you have to pass an entrance examination. And every student has to score highly on that to get to a university that ranks high in a prestige hierarchy. Well, that sounds awfully like the U.S. to me. Essentially, that's what the SAT is, right? It's a high-stakes test where an individual achieves a score that, to a large measure, there's a lot of debates about the SAT, but certainly has a fair bit to do with which university you will attend, and there's pretty clear hierarchies in terms of the universities in the U.S. And so again, I would say if we take the U.S. as a counterexample, we don't really see JUKU here, but all the reasons that are typically given in Japan don't necessarily tell me why you wouldn't see JUKU appearing in the U.S. And so that's in a way what keeps some of this research going. And I want to just, I think the more correct answer, and of course, you know, as academics, this is what we always do, say, well, it's much more complex than that. And it is. And so what I think happened in Japan largely was that in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, you have sort of a confluence of a number of factors. Some of them are economic, especially that family disposable income went up significantly in the early 1970s. At the same time, that number of children, the birth rate declined. And families looked to education, true enough, to invest into an individual. There were fewer kids. More money was invested into individuals. And thus, you have these sort of shadow schools emerging, these JUKU emerging. And that's where the first JUKU boom happens in the 1970s. That's where the big numbers of foundations are happening. And so much of what explains today's presence of the JUKU, I think, is largely historical in the sense that that's where the creation happened, was in the 1970s. And since then, we've seen a whole industry emerge that is the JUKU industry. One of the really interesting terms that I've picked up along in this research is that some of the people active in this industry refer to it as the Fuan Sangyo, the insecurity industry, because essentially what this industry is catering to is parents' insecurity. So as a parent, when you see the offering of a JUKU, if you're worried about the educational opportunities of your child, and if you're really worried about that, then the JUKU will come to you and say, for the small fee of $100, you can get peace of mind because you're sending your kids to extra education. And in many ways, in the current situation, that's a lot of what's going on, is that there's a real sort of sense of panic about Japanese education, I think very unreasonably so from my point of view, but there's a real sense of panic, and this JUKU industry is something that caters to that panic. And has become highly institutionalized in the process. What do these JUKU look like today then? Well, one of the reasons I'm doing this research is that in some ways we really don't know. We have no idea how many kids are going. There are no national numbers for ages, grades, or anything like that. As a summary, I would say it would not be very difficult if we went to Japan today to find a classroom in a regular school where every child was attending JUKU. And it would be very difficult to find a classroom where fewer than a quarter of the children were attending. And so depending on the age range and the geographic location that you find yourself in, somewhere between a quarter and 100% of kids will be attending JUKU at any given time. We have rough estimates of the number of schools that exist, but these numbers don't really differentiate between branches of corporate JUKU, for example, and franchise holders and the like, so it's a little bit hard to tell exactly what that means, but the general estimate that people agree about is about 50,000 schools in all of Japan, and given the number of children, that works out to be about one school per something like 300 students, just to give you a sense. I did a quick survey a couple summers ago in Vancouver, and I suspect Anchorage might be sort of a similar situation. Certainly, somewhat larger U.S. cities would be somewhat similar. And in all of Vancouver, with a population of about 2 million, we found about 80 schools that looked like JUKU. And so if you think of a density ratio, then the Japanese density is somewhere around 15 times higher. You have 15 more schools per student, or 15 times fewer students per school, if you like, if you prefer. So it's a huge market in Japan. Clearly, it's become increasingly dominated by corporate actors. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But what I'm talking about is based on, for those of you who are more inclined towards methodology and towards research, is what I've been doing over the past 2 years with a grant from the Social Science Humanities Research Council of Canada, is research the smaller schools, the ones that are operated by individuals, not by corporations. And I've visited about, getting close to about 40 of them over the past 2 years, all across Japan, not just in Tokyo, but in the Osaka area, in Kyoto, in Hiroshima, and out in a very rural prefecture called Shimane Prefecture. So one of the things that makes, in light of the global trend towards marketization, towards the introduction of market mechanisms that I talked about early on, one of the things that makes this insecurity industry so fascinating to me is that this is a situation that is fully marketized. This is quite close to what some of our colleagues in economics dream about as fully implemented consumer markets. It's a market that only has for-profit participants. All the juku are run for profit. They take all kinds of different organizational forms. I already mentioned the corporate ones, franchises, and so forth. We see all those organizational forms everywhere. The market is entirely, as of now, entirely unregulated by the government. With all due respect to the Japanese government and Council Fujita, his colleagues in the Ministry of Education don't want to acknowledge that juku exists. As far as they're concerned, juku do not exist, even though all their children are going. Children are free to participate or not to participate. In fact, some of the most interesting people you meet is the parents or the students in a class where everyone is going except for one kid, and the kid is doing quite well in school. And then you want to ask, okay, how does that happen? But that'll be a different project. And especially for areas like Tokyo, Osaka, or so forth, you have very high mobility within urban areas, so that parents or students would think nothing of taking the train or the subway for an hour and a half or 2 hours to travel to a juku. So you can really think of a place like the Kanto area, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, as one big integrated juku market with thousands of offerings that people can choose from. And so this is, in many ways, a very real consumer market in the way that the people who want to set up voucher systems, for example, or charter schools and the like can only dream about, because vouchers are inherently quite limited in geographic applicability and the kind of choices that parents have in them and so forth. And so in my mind, at least, something like supplementary education in Japan is actually quite a good test to see what exactly marketizing education does and what a marketized education may look like around the world. The advocacy for juku is the same, of course, as it is in some ways for vouchers and for charter school systems. And so the claim is, when schools become for-profit schools and operate on a profitability principle, they become more responsive to consumers. Sounds beautiful, doesn't it? It sounds like, oh, great, all our demands will be met, everyone will be quite happy. But that's what the advocacy for juku in Japan is as well. As far as public figures talk about juku, they say, well, the pedagogy there, the teaching methods, must be superior to conventional schools because the constant need to attract and retain customers, right? Because since it's voluntary, any student that is coming to your juku at any point may just simply drop out. And so if you're a bad teacher, then they will simply leave. And the argument goes, this certainly keeps teachers on their toes, but it also keeps students on their toes because they could be dismissed from juku at any time, right? So unlike a public school student who essentially cannot be dismissed from school, a juku operator at any moment can dismiss a student because he or she maybe is not displaying the right attitude in some way or another. And that's what the reason people think of juku pedagogy or of juku teaching methods as a good thing is because of this application of market principles. What's happened to this market then over the past couple decades? I've mentioned a little bit that we increasingly see corporate involvement in this market. So the juku boom of the 1970s started initially with individuals who chose to open a juku. Since there are no entry barriers, anyone can hang out a shingle and say, here's my juku, students come if you like. And that's how things got started. Then in the mid-90s is where most people sort of placed the turning point. Large corporations became increasingly involved in this area, or some of the juku that had been founded earlier became large corporations themselves. Some of the examples of such corporations now have revenue of over $1 billion. And a lot of the big revenue companies are in publishing, that publish study aids of various sorts. You know, in the US, the sort of example would be the ubiquitous SAT practice test manual sort of things. But there's a whole industry of study aids in Japan, and that is run through publishing houses, some of which have then since then either opened juku of their own as chains or acquired them along the way. One of the quite prominent ones, a company called Binessa, recently bought the Berlitz language schools that you know from really around the world that are quite active. So they're huge businesses. And this corporate side has come to dominate over the last 10, 15 years or so. They dominate economically in terms of revenues. They dominate to some extent geographically. One of the very interesting features is if you go to large cities in Japan, you will no longer find individually operated juku close to train stations. Because the students commute by trains, the corporate schools have taken over the locations that are close to train stations. And so the kind of schools that I visit that are run by an individual and have maybe 100 to 200 students or so have increasingly moved into neighborhoods away from train stations where they have their own sort of niche in this market. One of the other parts of this corporate dominance is that there's been a big lobby that's emerged. As I mentioned, the Ministry of Education has chosen to ignore this whole industry and is now faced with a very large industry that makes its opinion heard. And if policymakers were now to decide that there's some aspects of supplementary education that are detrimental to public education, perhaps, or that they don't appreciate or they wish to regulate, I think that would be very difficult at this point because that industry has grown so large. And is making sure that they're heard. The schools that I visit, these smaller schools, generally report that they had their peak enrollments as schools, if they've existed over long periods, somewhere in the mid-90s, and have since then been cut roughly in half. And part of that is the demographic trends I want to talk a little bit about more in a moment, but part of that is also that the corporate schools have taken over this market. And this may be increasingly so recently because larger corporations are able to invest in technology in a way that small juku cannot. And so as an educator myself, coming from a public university, my eyes pop out when I see some of these juku and the kind of equipment they have and the kind of online tutoring, real-time online tutoring facilities they have for massive numbers of students in a way that certainly my university isn't going to be able to afford anytime soon, but that they're building up on a massive scale, also in a way that the smaller juku are completely unable to do. In fact, they typically don't even buy PCs because they'd have to replace them so quickly with technological change they can't do that, whereas the large firms, of course, are quite able to do that. Okay, let me get back a little bit then to that second trend that I see as interacting with this increase of a marketization of education and talk about demography around the world, but really focused on Japan. As I mentioned, Japan is far below replacement rate in terms of birth rates and has been so since the late 1970s. The flip came somewhere in the late 1970s. As you all know, Japan continues to be very densely populated. In a way, it's sort of the antithesis of Alaska, especially if you count population density of habitable areas in Japan, a country that's mostly mountainous and has actually relatively little area that's habitable in a reasonable way. So a very high density of population. Population is currently somewhere around 127 million. In U.S. terms, what's that, about 40% roughly of the U.S. population or so. But if you extrapolate from current trends, and of course this is always a bit dicey with demographics because there's not that much reason to assume that the current birth rate tells you much about the 2040 birth rate, but at current trends, the Japanese population would shrink by about a quarter by the middle of this century. So in the next somewhere around 40 years or so, the population would go down to somewhere around 90, 80 million. And that obviously is seen as a drastic shift with a fair bit of worry by some and is welcomed by others. Japan, is not, as I mentioned before, is not alone in this. The Korean birth rate is even lower. I think the current world record is Macau, which probably doesn't count because it's relatively small. But Japan is in relatively good company with a very low birth rate. Some of the causes people have looked to explain why birth rates have declined. As I said, this is a global sort of a trend, so it's a little hard to grasp specifics. But for Japan especially, people have talked about inflation of real estate prices over the past 20, 30 years. It's just kind of difficult to afford a house where you can house more than two kids. And so that's keeping birth rates down to some extent. The age of women at first birth, at the birth of their first child, has been rising consistently, and that's part of larger social trends. And that limits to some extent the number of children that women will have in total, and availability of contraception. And there's a lot of other factors that make for decrease the birth rate over time. The other side of this, a phenomenon that Japan is facing very rapidly, is the aging of society. Currently, somewhere around a fifth of the Japanese population is over 65. So if you think of it roughly as retirement age, that is expected to rise to somewhere perhaps around 40% by the middle of the century. That somewhere around 40% of the population would in fact be of retirement age, and thus in economic terms at least no longer contributing, but relying on others to contribute to their pension payments and so forth. Here as well, Japan is ahead of other developed countries, but the trend in the development is more pronounced and has come earlier in Japan, but is not necessarily much worse. And to some extent, because Japan came so early, and that's largely due to a slightly less pronounced baby boom in the post-war era in Japan, and thus a less pronounced, you get all these sort of reverberations in demographics. So a slightly lower baby boom leads to a much lower echo baby boom and so forth, right? It just kind of keeps going like that. But one of the things that's happened in Japan is the government has talked for quite a while about the silver boom, and in fact that seems to be happening, that there's a lot of industrial effort devoted to catering to an aging population, and has led to some fascinating sort of developments economically. You have quite a bit of internal migration in Japan, continuing growth of urban areas, relatively slowly though, with some suburbanization happening as well, but you definitely have a depopulation of some agriculturally oriented rural areas where entire parts of certain districts are more or less depopulating. Not entirely, but certain significant numbers, especially of young families moving out. And then immigration, which is what makes the U.S. demographically quite different, and Canada and Australia makes all these countries quite different, is immigration, of course, of which Japan has had relatively little. With the one exception of return migration from the descendants of Japanese emigrants, particularly from South America, where Japanese descendants from Brazil, from Peru, are coming back to Japan, although the current economic downfall has seems to have put a stop to that. So how have the juku then reacted to these demographic element developments, right? Because juku are catering to kids, and so birth rate goes down, number of kids goes down, fewer kids, quite obviously fewer customers in some ways. So one of the first responses has been that in rural areas in Japan, educational options are disappearing. That's both supplementary juku kind of offerings as well as school options. There's a lot of schools being merged in rural areas of Japan. There's one school I've been visiting for 3 or 4 years now in Shimane Prefecture, which arguably is at the extreme end of this. But this school went from 90 students when I first visited it to now just about 50. And that's in the span of 3 years. And I think reasonably can be expected to close in the next couple of years. And is in a town that used to have 3 high schools that's down to 1. Educational competition is disappearing for some parts of the Japanese education system, and that everyone who applies gets in now. And that holds for some surprisingly prominent universities increasingly as well. So options are disappearing in the countryside. Options that were available before with higher population numbers are disappearing. That's countered a little bit by technology in the sense that the corporate juku offer, as I mentioned, various online tutoring forums, broadcast some of their lectures by satellite into the countryside. And so there are some factors that mitigate against this, but on the whole, options are disappearing in the countryside. Probably the biggest shift over the last 10 years has been that all of a sudden, juku everywhere, both the corporate as well as the small, have offered individual tutoring, one-on-one teaching of some sort. This used to be seen as only suitable to children who'd fallen behind. That is, the general perception used to be that the best learning occurs in a larger class context, and that has now shifted. Now, of course, when you're a juku operator and you know you're going to lose half your kids because of demographics, if you charge the other half twice as much, you're still doing well, and to some extent that's what's happened. So they're charging more now for individual tutoring than they used to in the class context, and that's been a very sort of economic and rational and management decision to respond. The variety of delivery methods, of teaching methods, has increased massively. I've mentioned satellite lectures, that sort of thing. There's various worksheet strategies. Kumon is probably active in Anchorage as well. It's been around for decades. It's based on worksheets, essentially, of routinized repetition of particular problems, especially in math and so forth. So there's a great variety of delivery methods now that have departed from this sort of setup, which is relatively traditional or conventional of a teaching person standing at the front and students taking in knowledge relatively passively. One of the other things that's happened, though, is that there are essentially no more new juku being founded. That you don't see the same kind of boom that was happening in the 70s, where this was really seen to be a flourishing industry. Right now, you would be fairly hard-pressed to find newly founded juku. And they're also facing significant successor problems. That is, the children of juku operators, who you could think of as a small and medium enterprise, as you would in manufacturing and so forth, generally do not take over the juku because it's seen to be a declining industry in some ways. The larger juku, of course, have looked to export markets to some extent to try, you know, if you have fewer customers at home, well, then you go abroad. And the Ministry of Economics and Trade in Japan has a huge publication, a white paper that talks all about the export chances. And this is an area that people are looking for. But the most significant shift really has been this pedagogical shift from a classroom setting to individualized tutoring, which didn't really exist in an appreciable way before. So then let me step back out and go to the larger global context. I think one of the conclusions that's been very startling to me, but has been also very pointed, is that I have seen absolutely no curricular diversity in the supplementary education market. And the research we've seen on charter schools in the U.S. confirms that in many ways, that what you don't expect, marketizing education does not lead to curricular diversity. And by curricular diversity, I mean does not lead to schools that offer any different substance. What it leads to is different organizational forms, franchises, smaller, larger schools, and the like. And it leads to some broadening of delivery methods, like the online sort of stuff that I've mentioned along. We also, as another conclusion from the Japanese situation, is we have absolutely no evidence on the effectiveness of any of this. That is not to say, I would not say by any stretch that juku are not effective, or any of their counterparts in any other countries are not effective, but we simply do not know. Because the measure that this market has developed for success is the pass rate in entrance examinations. But most of the juku are selective in the students they accept. And so when you take students in who perform well, surprise, surprise, they perform well on the next entrance examination. And we have no sense of any value added that's contributed by supplementary education, not just in Japan, but around the world. Nevertheless, you see supplementary education as a market, as an industry, highly institutionalized across East Asia. I've recently been to Korea and Taiwan, where the situation looks very much like it does in Japan. You increasingly see this particularly in urban areas of the People's Republic of China, less so in rural areas, but it's growing there. Elsewhere in Asia, you have huge supplementary education markets in India. But you could look to any continent and you could find prominent supplementary education systems. That's across Europe, across South America, across Africa. And in the areas where so far you haven't seen much of this institutionalized, like the United States, for example, it seems to be on the rise. No Child Left Behind includes some provisions to pay for the government to pay for tutoring services. It's still kind of shaking out, but includes some of that. And you may well expect some of that to show up in the U.S. One of the really interesting aspects of this that we see a lot in Vancouver or across Canada is some populations move with their educational institutions. So there's a lot of Chinese language, Bushiban is the Chinese equivalent of a juku, that are operating in Vancouver teaching math in Chinese. Or Korean operators with Korean Hakwon and so forth. And it's not going to take that long until some of those entrepreneurs get smart and start offering some of this in English. And it's very hard to resist. Those of you who are parents know that if your kid reports that, oh, there's those 3-4 kids in the class that are going to tutoring and are getting a leg up and are getting better grades, are you not going to spend that little bit of money just to buy that? And so I think it's a trend that in a lot of jurisdictions, policymakers ought to be quite aware of, not because it's good or bad. That's not my purpose here. And I've seen terrific teaching in some of these wonderful setups where I would be delighted to send my kids. I've seen some that aren't great, but that diversity is the same that you have in any schools. So my purpose is not to say it's good or bad, but I would hope that for policymakers and for the interested public, it's an area that everyone ought to be paying attention to. because it may well be coming your way in the near future. So what I've tried to do here is merge two big global trends. I think we see some demographic developments with birth rates going up. I think we see sort of a global policy trend towards market mechanisms in educational policy that is followed by policymakers in a lot of jurisdictions. As a result, if I had to predict the future, I think we'll see the rise of supplementary education in a whole number of countries and jurisdictions, further entrenchment in other countries where it exists already. I think we can also expect a decline in relevance of public policymaking on education, because marketization oftentimes means a privatization, for better and for worse, and it means that the state, to some extent, and quite literally in the U.S., the states lose control over education, which in many areas may well be a good thing, and in some areas many might think might not be a good thing, but is going to be a likely impact. And I think we can also expect to see rising inequality in education, because supplementary education always involves for-fee teaching and involves students and parents pointing up money that they can attend these kinds of institutions. And I'll leave it at that, and I would be delighted to hear your questions.
You've been listening to Dr. Julian Dierkes, Assistant Professor of Asia-Pacific Policy Studies at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. He was recorded speaking in Anchorage at the Alaska World Affairs Council on May 8, 2009. Following his talk entitled Fewer Children, More Customers, Changes in Japan's Supplementary Education System, Dr. Dierkes responded to questions from the audience. Juku is private education in addition to regular schooling. In the United States, we have a modestly growing sector of private education used instead of public education. The audience member wanted to know, to what extent is there private education in Japan that is education instead of, as opposed to in addition to?
Private schools are quite common, more common in urban areas than in rural areas, but have been legal and supported by the government with subsidies, with partial subsidies for budgets, essentially since the beginning of the Japanese modern nation state in the late 19th century. And they tend to cooperate a little bit more with the juku than the public schools do. And there have been some interactions between private schools and juku that are now also appearing in public schools. So some public school districts are now hiring juku to come in on Saturdays to teach, which is, of course, ironic because Saturday school was finally abolished. I think it was it 7 years ago? And so immediately, as soon as it was abolished, it was reintroduced in a privatized version. The other answer I would give to that, that's quite fascinating, is there are now some children, some students who are attending juku instead of regular school. And that's a legal gray area because they're not fulfilling their compulsory education obligation. And so the local authorities are kind of turning a blind eye to that. But there's a group of children that in Japanese are not, engage in something called futoko, that's school refusal, that simply will not attend the school that they've been assigned to, and that's a complex matter. But for some of those children now, some juku are catering to that by offering them instead of options rather than supplementary or additional. But the question is terrific in the sense that it's one of the puzzles that some of the schools I visit, where I think, well, this is a wonderful setting, I have to step back and say, but it's the second school they're going to. What's wrong with the first school, right? And I think that's one of the enduring puzzles of how this is shaping up.
Next, another audience member asked Dr. Dierkes to clarify the official curriculum in the juku. Do they follow the same curriculum as the public schools?
Okay, terrific. So to the extent that the schools continue and may well continue to follow the curriculum set by policymakers, that would be a reinforcement. Take the SAT, the U.S. situation as an example, though the SAT has nothing to do with state curricula, right? I mean, it's broadly covers the same ground, and so you would expect some of the math problems that show up on the SAT to also be something that a state curriculum may well cover, but they're not directly linked in any way, in the way that juku content in Japan is. And so as this whole industry emerges, if I'm right that it'll be growing in places where it hasn't really been seen, and to the extent that it's entirely unregulated and private industry, it doesn't have to cater It doesn't have to include the content that the public curriculum will include. In the Japanese case, in some ways, the public curriculum has been reinforced, although you could see counterexamples that there was an educational reform in 2002 that reduced curricular content. And so, for example, textbooks were reduced by somewhere around a quarter, not just of the pages, but of content as well. Well, some of the juku then taught the old curriculum and said, well, we're not going to go with this reduction because we think it's a problem and it's a hazard. We're going to teach the old curriculum, but they still relied on a public document.
How does teacher compensation and benefits in the juku compare to the teachers in the Japanese public schools?
Okay, that's a terrific question. Okay, so then on the supplementary side, that of course divides, because the kind of schools that I look at that are small and medium enterprise offer no benefits. They're not of a size that they would offer any benefits, right? And because they'll have 10 employees, and you take any firm, you could look to the U.S. or to Japan, of the size of 10 employees, and it doesn't offer benefits, essentially, right? Or very rarely will so. Pay is a little bit more difficult. So the corporate juku offer benefits. They offer career ladders. You can move up in a corporate hierarchy and so forth. They offer an annual bonus that's quite common to Japanese employment practices and the like. Pay is a little more difficult. There's all kinds of media reports on sort of star pay that especially popular teachers are earning millions. I don't think we really know. Maybe that's the case somewhere. On the whole, there is no unionization, obviously, of juku teachers. So on the whole, it's a more precarious employment than a public school teacher will be, where you achieve tenure and you're essentially unfireable. Pay is a little harder to say. Some of the operators are making relatively good money because they're business people, and they're able to maximize, they're able to raise tuition to maximize their profit. A lot of the operators I meet also have no interest in that whatsoever. They're educators, and they know they have to charge tuition so they can eat, survive, but they have no interest in becoming rich or anything close to it. And so, unfortunately, we can't really say. I think on the whole, though, given that they're in private businesses and tend to be in small businesses, the juku teachers will earn less. And most of the employees there are part-timers in any case, not full-timers, as you would expect in school.
As the father of a college graduate who was considered learning disabled in her youth, another audience member asked, are there any optional schools in Japan?
Terrific. Well, first of all, congratulations. With my three younger kids, I'm looking forward to that day. Of course, that's the other side of charter schools, right? I talked about charter schools as sort of a market mechanism, motivated policy. But the other side, of course, is that it has introduced some alternatives into U.S. education. That is relatively undeveloped in Japan. There's a lot of talk about that at the policy level. But I'm not entirely sure that's very serious, because I think when push comes to shove, it's about university entrance exams that structure this, that are based on the traditional curriculum. And so an alternative school would actually have relatively little chance. And it's one of the puzzles I've had. So, for example, the caricature version of the puzzle is, why are there no Waldorf juku, right? Why are there no juku that follow a radically different pedagogy? In a consumer market that is as sophisticated as Tokyo, which must rank amongst the most sophisticated in the world, how come there is not a niche of perhaps even wealthy parents that are looking for true alternatives in the way that some of the alternative schools in the U.S. offer them? But that hasn't happened. We haven't seen any of that. It remains a market that's highly structured by that one outcome that is measured, and that's the pass rate. And a lack of confidence in radical alternatives to provide success in that pass rate.
The next question from the audience. Are there any studies that prove if juku is effective in preparing kids for college and entrance exams? If not, is this a problem?
Finally, a short answer. No. Yeah, it's one of the puzzles that I faced along the way in this research. I started out in this area. I think in the introduction, Paul might have mentioned, I worked on history education, history textbooks. And I would give these kind of talks, and people would say, well, it doesn't matter what's in the textbook, because what the kids are learning happens in the juku. I'd say, oh, well, that's terrific. I just need that footnote to that research literature on what happens at juku, but it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist on the academic side, and it doesn't exist in terms of the measuring effectiveness. It doesn't exist for the businesses. What they do measure is these pass rates, but there's no accounting for selection. at all, right? So as I said, if you went to any school and selected the top 10 students and then took them to any form of teaching for the next 2 weeks and had them apply to college, they would do well. Surprise, surprise, right? There's a little bit of an attempt now. This England is a bit ahead in these matters where they're trying, the league tables they're doing for schools, they're trying to do as value added now. And so what that means is they'll administer a test at the beginning of the school year and compare a school's result with the national average, and then they'll do a test at the end of the school year and again compare to the national average. And so when you have achievement relative to some sort of standardized national average, then you can say, okay, this particular school may have performed better or worse than other schools with the same content and so forth. That does not exist for the Jugu. And in some ways, I think the operators would not be necessarily keen on that because they're making good money as it is.
In reference to public policy issues with education in Japan, do you believe that the government should have a monopoly on education?
So that's I have no stake in these questions. I obviously have personal opinions on that, but those have relatively little to do with my research. My main conclusion to policymakers is they should be aware of the potential of supplementary education growing, and then decide whether they, and that means ultimately us, whether we want that or not. For example, the Korean government has tried for the past two decades to suppress supplementary education. It was illegal and is highly regulated in terms of work operating hours and money and so forth. And it's been stupendously unsuccessful in that attendance has risen, if anything. And by most accounts, competition is fiercest in Korea at the moment, sort of anecdotally people report. And so there clearly is a desire with parents and with students to look for options and to seek them. And I have no professional opinion on that necessarily. I do have an opinion that I think it's hazardous for policymakers in education to dismiss the growth of supplementary education as something that they don't need to know about. Because when you think about a situation where a teacher is facing a classroom where perhaps half the children are, in terms of content, are ahead by 2 years, and which would not be an unusual situation in a Japanese classroom, that obviously means something for what that teacher would do with those students and how he or she would treat the other half or how they would treat the class, the part of the class that's ahead. And I think that's very important for policymakers to be aware of.
Another audience member asked, to what extent are Japanese parents directly involved in their children's classroom?
No, I think that's not the case generally. There's very little parental involvement. Involvement extends primarily to the choice of a school. And that's the moment where parents pay attention, select a school, and then when the students come home, especially the mothers, colloquially known as the kyoriku mama, the education mama, are quite involved in homework and the like, but are not involved within the actual school. I also have to say I found it fairly surprising how little questioning or involvement of parents there is in the juku, because the sales point is that they cater to consumers, students' needs and interests and demands, but parents are in fact very reluctant to probe operators of juku on pedagogy or any of those matters. They will take the results, the pass rates, at face value and say, I don't care how you get the kids to pass, I drop them off tomorrow afternoon, I pick them up 4 hours later, and if they do better, I'm happy. And so in general, there's been very little parental involvement, I think.
What do you expect will happen if market forces do end up playing a role in these juku in the future? In the Anchorage School District, for example, we have construction and soon-to-be health academies that students can attend after the regular school day, which is somewhat like a juku. Students receive credit and specified training, which directly impacts their employment here and our workforce needs here in Alaska. So it is market-driven. Do you see any similar forces happening in Japan?
Yeah, that's another interesting area. In terms of my research, I focus on the academic ones, the ones that shadow what the schools do. And so what you're describing is a little bit outside of that. But just on this last research visit in March, I went to a school that first time I went to sort of an adult education juku, and this was preparing students for the entrance exam to a nurses training course. It was not doing it the way you describe it, with support perhaps from the industry, that perhaps hospitals would say we will support in terms of curriculum or maybe even funding. But the JUCO, certainly one of the responses to demographic shifts is also to look to other areas where they can educate. And vocational education is one area that you might well see that happening. Industry has not been involved. Perhaps surprisingly as well, large companies have not involved themselves by purchasing JUCO chains or JUCO corporations. I mean, you could think of, if you're a large Japanese company and you know that there's an outfit that's dedicated to publishing education materials and running courses, well, you might well say, oh, well, that's a good thing to buy and we can do our in-house training that way or so. But that's not happened generally for a number of reasons. That would take a bit longer.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Julian Dierkes, Assistant Professor of Asia-Pacific Policy Studies at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Fewer Children, More Customers, Changes in Japan's Supplementary Education System, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, May 8, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.